Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning, and welcome to the second day of the October term of the South Dakota Supreme Court being held on campus of Northern State University. If you have not had an opportunity to do so, we do have various publications available for you in the lobby. The first one with our seal on the cover is a synopsis of all 9 oral cases that we will be considering this term, and also tells you a little bit about each one of us as justices and how the system functions. The second book that's available is also gray. It has a picture on the cover, and this is a brief pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The third publication, which is available, is a blue-covered book, which is simply a narrative explaining how the court system works in the state of South Dakota. The court would like to welcome today high schools from Aberdeen Christian High School, Condie High School, Edmond Central School District, Great Plains Lutheran High School of Watertown, Hitchcock High School, James Valley High School, Redfield High School, and the South Dakota School for the Blind and Visually Impaired. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Jesse Krebs. For the appellant, Mr. Krebs, is Mr. Timothy Wrench, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the State of South Dakota, the appellee is Ms. Ann Meyer, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. Mr. Wrench, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, may it please counsel, and members of the audience. I represent Jesse Krebs, and he was 16 years old in the summer of 2003 when his life changed, and he went through a crossroads that many people never have to go through. And what I am here asking for today is that this court will look at the decision of the Juvenile Transfer Court and reverse that decision. And I'm also asking this court to enforce the discovery orders that are laid down by the circuit courts across the state.
Well, he would be 18 now then, or very close, wouldn't he?
Correct.
Doesn't that moot your argument?
Well, no, it doesn't moot the argument because the jurisdiction for the juvenile court is up to the age of 21, and just because a person turns 18 doesn't automatically disqualify them for treatment in juvenile court. This court has previously remanded juvenile transfer proceedings where a person was close to the age but not at age 18, specifically speaking State versus Horse, and it in no way negates his right to talk about the vitally important transfer hearing and the rights that surround that hearing and the process that should be in place. All right. By way of background for the members of the audience, if this case stands for one thing, it should be you listen to your parents and nothing good comes after 2 o'clock in the morning, because Jesse Krebs found himself in a situation in the summer of 2003, out way past dark, and he was someplace where he never should have been. And he went there because his friends asked him to go there, and he ignored his gut, which told him to stay home, and it changed his life forever. On that day, he was convinced by his friends to meet another friend in Rapid City, go from Box Elder to Rapid City, and they were ultimately going to go to a party, and as it turned out, watch a fight between two girls. One of the girls was hosting the party, and the other girl apparently had some conflict with her over a boy. And Jesse Krebs, who'd injured his ankle badly that night and could hardly walk on it, didn't want to go, but he ended up going because he had the vehicle, and he didn't want to let these kids, these people, use his vehicle without him being present. And that decision changed his life. It changed his life. He ended up at this party, and as it turned out, he went with two of his friends, Stephen Sandoval and Brian Mazzoni. They were the males that came along with him. And those three ended up fighting 6 males who were already at the party. And Jesse's position was, at the trial of this matter, that he found himself in a fight for his life, and he had to use a knife in order to save his own life. Now, the jury rejected his argument and convicted him of voluntary manslaughter, acquitted him of second-degree murder. And that's what brings us here to the court today, the fact that he was convicted of that.
Isn't it of some significance that he had this knife on his lap in the car on the way to this event. I mean, that's more than just staying out at too late and not going where your gut shows you.
I would agree with you that if someone looks at a situation and just sees a person with a knife on their lap, that can be of significance. But remember, Jesse Krebs was a young man who was working construction full-time and routinely carried this short fixed-blade knife that was quite dull that he used for his chores and things like that. It was something that he carried with him like a comb. In fact, I believe the evidence was that it was in his back pocket. He sat in the back seat of his own vehicle because he could not drive, and he put it up on his lap because it was poking him in the rear end. And when he stepped out, he put his knife back in his pocket. So it's not a situation where you have somebody who's sitting there holding a knife deciding that they're going to try to hurt somebody with the knife or try to prepare for some battle with the knife. And from that standpoint, it's different than someone else just holding a knife on their lap.
But didn't the trial judge find that of great significance in this case?
Well, the juvenile transfer judge actually didn't talk greatly about the knife being placed on his lap. What the juvenile transfer judge said was, and I will quote it so I get it exactly, "The minimum I have is evidence that he intentionally took a knife under circumstances where he would intentionally anticipate there to be a physical conflict, and that knife was used intentionally approximately 5 times on the victim in this case." That's different than just having a knife and carrying a knife and happening to have it when a conflict arises. What the judge in the juvenile transfer proceeding found was that the existence of that knife, intentionally taking that knife to the party, is what tipped the scales in the balance of keeping Jesse Krebs in juvenile court, contrary to the many teachers who came in and attested to his very, very good qualities, contrary to the psychological evaluation that showed he was a person who was amenable to rehabilitation in the juvenile justice system, contrary to the testimony of the leader of the Juvenile Services Center in Rapid City that he was an outstanding inmate, and contrary to the evidence. This was not a situation where you have someone carrying a knife to hunt down another and to stab them. This is a situation where you have a young man who was trying to do the best he could in his life, who was well respected by his teachers, his peers, by the members of the JSC staff, and was shown to have the psychological profile of a person who could be rehabilitated, ending up in a fight and having a knife. It's still our position that the existence of that knife saved his life.
What about the fact, though, that he stabbed this victim 5 times?
If you look at 5 stab wounds just on the face of it, it makes it look bad, like someone is going up and, man, I'm going to kill this person, and that's all there is to it. There was one fatal wound that happened to puncture an aorta. The remainder of the wounds were superficial wounds. All of those wounds were consistent with what Jesse Krebs explained had happened after he believed he was passing out, after he was being pummeled on the head, after he thought he was going to die and decided to stab upwards to get the people who were attacking him away. The trajectory of those stab wounds were consistent with stabbing upwards, not stabbing someone in the stomach as they're laying on the ground, as the state's theory was.
Did the transfer judge have all of that information, or did that information come out later in the jury trial?
That information came out in the jury trial, and the point of challenging the problem with the transfer hearing here is this. When you look at the transfer hearing, the state ran just a skeletal case. They called the coroner to talk about the condition of the body. The coroner happened to be a deputy who had responded to the scene. They didn't bring in any fact witnesses that talked about what happened there that night, and then they bring in people who talk about what Jesse Krebs said afterwards. And our position here is this. The juvenile court judge went beyond the scope of the evidence and did not therefore have substantial evidence to keep this matter in adult court as is required by the law, because the court gleaned that from the record in a fashion that doesn't allow it to exist. It is not there in the record. The only fact witness who testified at the time of the juvenile transfer hearing was very supportive of the self-defense claim. She was friends with both sides of these groups. She knew them, and she testified that it seemed like the guys who came to the party, which included Krebs, it appeared as though they were being ganged up on by the guys who were at the party, and it looked like they were coming out of the shadows and attacking. So when the judge at the juvenile transfer hearing says this is a case which is the fundamental issue, is taking of the knife. And he says, and if you take a knife, you take a weapon to a place where you expect conflict, then you expect to possibly have to use that knife. And if you expect to possibly have to use that knife, you expect that someone could get killed or stabbed 5 times. That is the problem. You cannot look at that juvenile transfer hearing and come away logically with that finding if the finding is to be based on substantial evidence. And that's the issue here.
Let me get this, the facts straight, though. As I understand it, they went to the party uninvited. They weren't guests, invited guests. They knew that this other, the girl that was, that Mr. Krebs was in the car with, was going to have brass knuckles, and that she was going to use the brass knuckles to hurt another girl at the party. And Mr. Krebs knew that they were going to the party and there was going to be a conflict. That certainly came out in the transfer hearing, didn't it?
That did not come out in the transfer hearing, and let me explain why. One of the words here that's been dangerous throughout this case is the word they. They knew this, they knew that. What Jesse Krebs knew is that they were going to meet Rihanna Root, the person who was going to fight this Tank Shearson, at this bar. As they're gone and as they're leaving, he doesn't know that Brian Mazzoni is bringing these brass knuckles for this gal to...
He knew there was going to be a fight, but he didn't know the brass knuckles were going to be...
He didn't know the brass knuckles, and standing around and watching a fight is one thing versus... being in a situation where you would be involved in the fight yourself. In fact, if you look at the way this thing came down and use the evidence that we now know what happened at the trial, what really happened is the three boys from the Krebs side, they walk in, they shake hands with the men from the other side, and everybody's actually trying to stop these girls from fighting, saying, don't fight, you don't need to do this, this is dumb, don't do this, don't do this. So this isn't a situation where they thought, okay, we're going to go back this girl up, she's going to pound this other girl, and we're going to clean up the mess. It was nothing like that.
That's how it ended up, though.
Well, they didn't clean up any mess. That's not how it ended up at all.
They ended up basically at war with the people who were having the party. They came to a party uninvited, and they ended up at war with the people who were invited to the party.
They came to the party with a young lady named Tasia McVitie, who knew both sides. She was invited to the party. I will agree with you. I don't think there'd been any communication where they'd been invited to the party. When they came up to the party, this is a place where there were regular parties. When they came up to the party, people shook hands. This is not something where people snuck up and pounced or snuck up and performed an attack. This was a situation where they arrived, they tried to stop them from fighting, the girls start to fight, and then all of a sudden, all heck breaks loose, and people start fighting.
You know, the facts are interesting and challenging and difficult, but you know, it comes down to me to the question of your client made a very bad decision, a single instant in his life. He made a bad judgment, now it's affecting the rest of his life. And the question for me is, do we, as judges, allow this mistake made on behalf of a 16-year-old to be counted against him, or do we allow the juvenile system the opportunity to rehabilitate him before he's 21? That's what this comes down to, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does. And it would be our position that the evidence presented at the juvenile transfer hearing would show that if ever there was a case that should have remained in juvenile court, this case would be it. Never do you have a situation where so many teachers will come in and say what they said about this young man. We had 3 teachers testify, all of whom had master's degrees, and one of them had 2. They said things like, he was the kind of a student that they taught for. He was the type of student that made their day. He was, and let me just quote it, he's a wonderful kid, and I can honestly say he's one that touches your heart. He's kind to everybody. In fact, based upon that testimony, the juvenile transfer judge said, were this act not committed, I'd expect you to run for president or have every other opportunity and be a very positive contributing member of our community.
Now, you've spoken at great length about his past and the recommendations. Did you offer that transfer judge a program of rehabilitation if he was kept in the juvenile system, or are you going to leave that to the judge and correctional facility?
Well, there are a number of the juvenile system is the juvenile system.
Sure it is.
The juvenile system is what we offered up for rehabilitation, and the psychologist testified that he was amenable to rehabilitation in the present juvenile system. So that's what we offered up, was the present juvenile system. In fact, the judge found that the present juvenile system could likely rehabilitate this young man, but then found that it wasn't in his best interest or the public's best interest, because he intentionally took a knife to a place where he expected someone could get killed, which does not exist on that juvenile transfer hearing.
Didn't that psychologist also concede on cross-examination that there was no gang involvement in this situation?
Well, I think that was in response to a cross-examination question where they were assuming that. It has never been Jesse Krebs' position that he was involved in a gang. In fact, he has denied that. I think what the psychologist said was that if there was gang involvement, that could change her opinion. I think that was the testimony, as I recall it. I don't have it in front of me. But to bundle up this juvenile transfer issue, what it comes down to is this. If we really are to put meaning in the purpose behind the juvenile system, and that is to rehabilitate, not to punish, and if we agree that it's a critically important juncture, a critically important procedural step, and that we know the law requires substantial evidence at that point to justify allowing a child to stay in adult court versus the juvenile court, we all must look at this juvenile transcript and ask, is there substantial evidence to support the judge's findings, the contradictory finding of likely rehabilitation versus danger to the public? And it's our position here that that critically important hearing was flawed because the judge pulled this out of something other than the evidence that was before the court.
And it's your position that all of the evidence that came in during the murder manslaughter trial cannot be used for the purposes of the transfer hearing?
Correct, correct.
Now, you would have had the right, and my recollection is that you did not, you could have petitioned to the Supreme Court for an intermediate appeal once the transfer hearing was occurred.
That's correct.
Right, and you didn't appeal there?
We did not file the intermediate appeal because they were scheduling the trial, and I filed three of those intermediate appeals, and they'd never been accepted, and I figured that I'd use it at the end, if I got that far. To be frank, I thought I was going to win the case.
You thought you were going to stay in, you thought you were going to win the case, or thought you were going to win the transfer?
I thought I was going to win the trial in the adult
the trial.
Court because of the testimony of the witness who knew both sides, and I didn't think that it could ever get any better than that.
Okay, but now for the purposes of the manslaughter conviction, we have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, don't we?
That's
so
correct.
So if there's testimony that he knew there were going to be brass knuckles there, and that he knew those people coming to the party were going to have to come to the rescue of this person, or if he knew there was going to be a fight, all of that works against your client to support the manslaughter conviction, doesn't it?
Well, I disagree with some of the things you've said. I don't think that he
knew. No, I know, but it's the spin. We have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, right?
You do, but that doesn't relate back to the transfer hearing. The question for the transfer hearing...
I realize that, okay. But as far as the manslaughter conviction is concerned, we have to take all the evidence and the evidence most favorable to the verdict.
I'm not even challenging the verdict in the sense of the sufficiency of the evidence. What I'm challenging is that it shouldn't have gotten into adult court because the judge didn't have the evidence in the record to support what he said.
Okay.
And then I'm saying that these other issues require reversal.
Okay. The other issues you're claiming, yeah, are procedural rather than on the merits, right?
Well, no, I don't think that they're just procedural. The other issue is a discovery issue, the second one that I would get into.
Right,
and
it affects
yes, that's
the
procedural,
merits.
And that affects the merits. So I guess you could say it's procedural, but if we would have known about that information, the trial would have been handled differently, and it's our position that that discovery violation is something that that justifies relief.
Well, maybe I didn't go far enough. I'm saying that they're procedural. That doesn't mean they don't affect the merits of the case, but they were procedural discovery matters.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Say we agree with you and we reverse this case, where do the proceedings go from here? What would you think would be in the best interest of society and your client? And be a little more specific, if you can, than just using words like rehabilitation.
All right, I will do that. First of all, he's been in the penitentiary for approximately 2 years now, or however long it's been since the date of his sentencing. If this matter were remanded back to juvenile court for further proceedings, for an adjudication, he could be placed in the same juvenile facility any other 17-year-old would be placed in.
2 minutes.
Okay, wow, went fast. And he's the type of a person who could be forced or ordered to comply with conditions of probation and things of that nature. But I agree with you, it's up in the air. Where do you go to find something for a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old? That's the best way that I can answer that question. I don't know. I just know that juvenile transfer hearing had a problem with it. The discovery issue, to move into that quickly so that I can deal with that, comes down to this. There was a witness who gave the state information at the last minute that Jesse Krebs was trying to hurt himself and scratch himself, and his friends were pummeling him and beating him up in an effort to make themselves look like they'd been hurt. The state used that against us. We moved for a mistrial. It's our position that under State versus Sully, that since there was an order in effect, the prosecution should have provided that information. Since the prosecution did not provide that information, the court erred in not finding a discovery violation because we didn't have it, and we were prejudiced because it in all probability must have produced some effect upon the jury's verdict.
When that came up, and you were surprised by it, did you ask the court for a continuance?
I did not.
Tell me exactly the time frame. I understood the state discovered this evidence the weekend before the trial.
That's correct.
And did the trial start on a Monday then?
Yes, it did.
And so did they disclose to you Monday morning?
Nothing. She was testifying to it.
That's the first time you heard of this?
That's case. The first time I heard about it.
Well, you knew about the witness, though, right?
I knew about the witness, and I'd received the reports, and I cross-examined the witness about the fact that they'd not reported that to the police. But it still clearly is inculpatory evidence. The state used it in the cross-examination of Jesse Krebs by asking him, in an attempt to make your story a little bit better, you actually scratch yourselves on the stomach, don't you? You inflict your own injuries so you can make this self-defense look even better than it is. So that's information that was dropped on us in a complete surprise, contrary to the order which said they had to provide it, whether it was reduced to writing or not.
Your time has expired.
My apologies. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
And the state disagrees with the defense. There's a lesson to be learned from this case. It is that your choices have consequences. And we're going to begin by talking about the transfer hearing. What Judge Tice found was that the juvenile system is a preferred route for juveniles because they can redeem and assist juveniles in their treatment and in making them citizens that they can go forward being citizens of our society and be productive. But in this case, what the concerns were the protection of the public and the severity of the offense. And the dull knife issue does not help the defense. Our witness testified at the transfer hearing that these were puncture-type wounds, not slash wounds like a dull knife. These were wounds that went deep, and they perforated the victim's abdominal aorta. And the next point that we'd make is that the victim certainly could not have jumped up into his own knife. The defense said this just happened. The state put on a witness, Thad Duty, who said that the kids were hanging out that night at the defendant's apartment. He came home from work. The defense characterized this knife as some kind of construction knife. It was a serious weapon. It is a fixed blade, double-edged knife. And the defendant came home. He went home, and then he went to the party. He made a choice to take that knife to the party where he seriously injured the victim so badly that no one could save his life. Even though there were attempts to do so, there was no way to save his life.
You indicated by motion that it was stabbing wounds coming down. Was there any testimony by an eyewitness that was the case?
I'd say there were two. We have one of the witnesses is A.J. Wisely, and this is at trial. What he saw in this chaotic fight was the victim down on the ground and being stabbed in the gut, his word, with a knife. We also had the victim's girlfriend, Sierra Hardman, and she said that the defendant was overcome by two people and he couldn't get up after that. He had to use his lighter to see the wounds in his stomach. He felt the pain, but he couldn't figure out what was wrong.
You said the defendant. You meant the
victim?
I meant the victim,
I'm sorry.
So we do have witnesses that show that the defendant was down. In the juvenile transfer system, you asked Mr. Wrench what the best option would be, and we don't have long-term secure facilities, and I'm outside my record, but for a violent juvenile offender, we don't have secure facilities for a violent offender. That would be a placement that would be made out of state. And their witness found that the defendant could be rehabilitated, and Mr. Wrench went through the witnesses that they called. Certainly our cross-examination of their witnesses, our own fact witness was Thad Duty. He said that the defendant came back from this party and indicated that I stabbed Chance. They made up a story that this was actually the victim's knife, and they tried to hide the knife. Those are calculated acts.
To go back to the stab wounds for a minute, were the stab wounds into the body going upward towards the heart, or were they going downward towards the hips of the person?
My recollection of the forensic pathologist's testimony is that they were going down.
Okay, and supposedly the person was laying on the ground.
On the ground and not able. I want to make sure we know that this victim is unarmed. It's not equal force. This victim does not have a flashlight, brass knuckles, a fist pack, any of these knives. He's unarmed. He's out there in the middle of a field, and he's losing his life because he's bleeding to death internally.
He's an older, larger person than the defendant?
We disagree with that. When you look at the juvenile transfer hearing, the defendant is 5'7", 145. The victim is about 6'1", and 165. There's only about a 20-pound difference, and that doesn't make up for the fact that the victim was unarmed. The size factor is immaterial.
At the transfer hearing, did the trial court look at all at what rehabilitative programs would be available on the adult side, assuming the pen?
Well, there is a pen, but he didn't look at that particular factor. His main concern was the choice that this defendant made to take the knife to that party where everybody knew there was going to be trouble. But what he did look at is that we lose jurisdiction over juveniles at the age of 21. The best our state has to offer a juvenile in this circumstance is 5 years in a facility where you'd be getting aftercare. After that, there isn't anything else that we can do for that juvenile because we lose jurisdiction over him. By practice, as we've seen in our prior cases, these juveniles are going to be out at 18 and back in the community, and what the court was looking at was the protection of the public.
But that wasn't really part of the evidence, was
no,
it?
No, I'm outside my record.
And there was no evidence presented in regard to how this child would be treated in the penitentiary or what programs were available there as opposed to the juvenile. Should that be part of the requirement that a judge needs to know in order to weigh the evidence here? And whether it's in, because you still have to look at what's in the best interest of the child as well as society.
I think it's something that many judges would find useful, and you certainly see it in the other cases like Jensen. In particular, Kevin McLean testified from the Department of Corrections. It is useful, but as I read the juvenile transfer record, what the state was conveying to the judge and what the judge was looking at was the severity of the offense and the protection of the public. And, you know, his record
does
is
he,
what it
does
is.
Does he say protection of the public?
Does the court say protection
of
the public?
Yeah, I don't remember. That wasn't a finding, was it, or was it?
I think the way that he said it was, I have concerns that your character, of course, is good, but I have concerns about your future potential dangerousness, and I would read that as, you know, okay, this defendant's life-threatening actions.
So really, I think, though, really, when you look at this whole situation, it comes down to what tipped the scale and probably what weighed heavily on the judge's decision to keep it in adult court was the nature of the crime itself, the seriousness of the crime itself, and that somebody's dead because of it. Is that enough, he obviously looked at all the other criteria that's required under the statute, but that sort of was the thing. Is that enough?
It is enough. It is enough. We have cases that say that it's in the interest of both the juvenile and the public. And so both interests have to be met by whatever decision is made, whether you're going to be in adult court or you're going to be in a juvenile court. And that is enough in this case to meet that, to overcome that burden. If you look at it in terms of what was best for that community and those people, everyone who got hurt by this crime, all those concerns are what we're looking at in terms of what long range is going to happen to that community. And you can't ignore the fact that there's a gang involvement here. Their own expert found that it was a known gang involvement. Even though the defendant is denying that it's there, that was a factor. And I think your known gang involvement, the violence of this crime, the fact that you're protecting the public, and the severity of that crime are the factors that got us to adult court, and that was appropriate.
I don't remember that the trial court, though, weighed so much the gang issue.
He didn't mention it, but it certainly is in the record, and retaliation was a concern. No, he did not base it on that factor alone, but it certainly would be a concern. I don't think he did mention it either. I think he was mainly concerned about that weapon.
You say that we should not consider...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You say that the state of South Dakota does not have facilities for violent juvenile offenders. Should that be our concern? The legislature has passed a law providing that we should provide for rehabilitation for juvenile offenders. It doesn't make a distinction between violent and nonviolent. Is it? I mean, aren't we subverting the law if we say, well, we're not going to apply the rehabilitation because the state has failed to provide these facilities?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it like that, but I don't think the state is actually failing to provide the facilities. What happens is that you go into an out-of-state private placement facility. Those are hard to find, and that's we're not disagreeing that this juvenile could be not be rehabilitated. There's obviously evidence in the record, and the court found that he could be.
The judge said he could be rehabilitated.
Yes, he did.
And now you're saying, well, disregard that because.
No, I'm not.
Because we can't, we don't have the facilities.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the secure facility is certainly a consideration. You can still rehabilitate this juvenile in an out-of-state program, assuming that a placement can be found. And I don't think that's circumventing the intent of the legislature. And when I read that statute, what the statute that's in question here, what keeps coming back is that there is a grave concern about the protection of the public and the seriousness of that crime. And I think you can fulfill both of those types of interests by transferring to adult court, where you go into a longer supervised term and you're also incarcerated for a longer period of time and break those gang ties, give this juvenile a chance to get educated and get some career training and that type of thing.
Ms. Myrett?
And I'm sorry, Justice Inter.
I'd like to ask you two questions that are not related to the transfer.
Okay.
Both of them relate to the evidence that was used at the trial.
Okay.
First, how could it possibly be relevant to any factual issue, this videotape of the distraught girlfriend and the body being taken out of the car? What relevant issue of fact could that have related to? I have trouble.
With the videotape?
Yeah, what that was proving.
The videotape.
It's relevant to the question of whether he committed manslaughter or murder. I can't see how that's relevant to anything.
From the perspective of the judge, Judge Trimble, who's the trial court, looked at that videotape three times and took the soundtrack off.
I understand.
Don't hear
that.
The sound.
But seeing somebody taken out of a car on a board and seeing a girlfriend who's hysterical about the death, what does that have to do with whether or not the defendant was guilty?
It has to do with the crime scene. It has to do with the emergency scene. It shows how all these witnesses, their lives intersected at this one point. And this is a homicide. Certainly the matter in which the victim lost his life is relevant to what's going on at the trial. It shows that particular moment in time. A number of witnesses testified about it. It shows exactly what's happening. And I think if you accept the defendant's argument, you're saying that the jury is going to be confused by the truth. It's good, solid evidence. All our patrol cars in South Dakota have videotapes. It's automatic that it comes on, and it shows exactly what's going down at that particular moment in time. It's impossible for me to imagine how dark it would be. I imagine it tells a juror what a dark night it was. They're out in the middle of nowhere, and it shows exactly what it looks like when the officer goes down the road, it's a gravel road, to the crime scene. Seen out in this remote area where they have this bonfire and they keep having these repeat parties. And so it essentially sets the stage for what was going on that night, which is certainly relevant to the story.
I thought the videotape was away from the crime scene and that the vehicle, because the vehicle had been stopped by officers who were responding to the scene.
You see both. You can't see, okay. You can't only see just the vehicle that's the officers, but you can also see Officer Osborne as he goes down Melody Lane to the area where you see all these cars, people milling around. There's two people milling around. You can't see the victim either. You can't see the injuries that the victim sustained. It certainly, we've had autopsy photographs go into trial. We've had crime scenes going in since 1988 when we had Lonis come down. That was a videotape of the crime scene. This is not as gruesome as Connect. It doesn't show anything up close. In fact, I could barely see the victim in the back of the
videotape. But that argument wasn't even used by the deputy state's attorney in trial. He didn't claim that it's going to show a moment in time of the post-crime scene.
That's what the judge said. It shows a particular moment in time that was relevant to this
crime.
Well,
yeah, but anything would do that. I mean, you know, if you took a video of this auditorium right now, that would show a moment of time. But Judge Zinner's question is, how is that relevant to the case? How is that relevant to any of the charges in the case?
How is it not relevant? It shows what's going on at that time in a homicide case.
Well, how is it relevant, a picture then of this auditorium? Because that shows a moment in time.
It does. It shows a moment in time that was critical to this murder case and to this homicide.
Tell me how it was critical to the murder case. That's what. How is it relevant?
Relevant to set the scene. To set the crime scene, to set the emergency scene.
It's after the crime scene.
It's before the death. It's the last half hour of the victim's life. It's good solid evidence of what happened out there at the scene when the victim lost his life.
The other evidentiary question I wanted to ask you about is the failure to provide the inculpatory evidence. I don't understand how the trial court could have found no discovery violation when the state learned of this evidence over the weekend, but did not disclose it Monday morning when the trial started. And also, I don't understand how, whether it's work product or not work product, how that has any impact on whether it should have been disclosed. The fact that you interviewed a witness, if the witness has exculpatory or inculpatory evidence, the state has a duty to disclose that. And they didn't do it Monday morning when that trial started. And I don't understand how the trial court could have found that that was not an error.
Well, we agree with you. We have discussed it. We've talked to the Pennington County State's Attorney, and we are conceding that that was not work product and that there was a discovery violation, but we're not conceding that the conviction should be reversed. This was not prejudicial to the defense. Because the defense had their three witnesses, the defendant, Mazzoni, and Sandoval, prepared to say, we didn't scratch each other, we never did that, and we never punched each other, we weren't scratching and punching each other. The other evidence that we have was a photograph that the state took of the defendant's stomach, and we have a photograph that the defense took. And the jury could see the photographs and decide for themselves. As you're indicating about the videotape, it can be helpful to aid the jury, and it can tell people what happened. The jury could look at this and see if those wounds were self-inflicted or not. So there's no prejudice from that discovery violation in this case, but we are conceding that it wasn't work product. And are there any further questions?
It's not.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Wrench, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Let me, before you start, just ask a question about the victim. Did evidence come out about the victim's background, whether he was a bully or had been in lots of fights before and was a provoker of fights?
Evidence did come out that he was a fighter, he was strong, he was tough. And we didn't get into any other background character evidence simply because the defendant did not know him. So, yeah, he was tough, but we didn't engage in character very much. I wanted to deal with the last issue first. It's interesting to say that there is no prejudice from this discovery violation, which has now been conceded. You know, prejudice is sometimes a hard thing to show, sometimes it's not a hard thing to show. And that's why I pointed the court to State versus Pasek, that talks about what prejudice is, and it says it in all probability must have produced some effect upon the jury's verdict and is harmful to the substantial rights of the defendant. If a person takes the stand in self-defense, and they're subjected to cross-examination by the prosecuting attorney, that can go to the heart of the case.
the heart of the case was self-defense. The prosecutor, as I read before, cross-examined exactly on that. You scratched yourselves to make up a story. You inflict your own injuries so that your self-defense looks even better than it is, don't you? That's because you know in your heart of hearts that you don't have a self-defense claim, right? To say that is not prejudicial is to ignore reality.
That also argued to the jury in the final argument?
I don't recall if it was argued to the jury in the final argument. My recollection is he relied on the testimony of Jamie Blackwell and said something to the effect that she had no reason to lie. That's my recollection. I don't have the cite. But if it wasn't in the final argument, it certainly was with the defendant to the heart of the defense, which is you know in your heart of hearts that you weren't defending yourself. I figured out an answer to the rehabilitation question that you asked of, and it actually exists in the record. I'm glad I thought about it now instead of WASTA. And you can find it at page 20 of appellant's brief, where Carla Levesque, who's the administrator of the Western South Dakota Juvenile Services Center, talks about the many programs she has for rehabilitation out there at JSC and how she's been responsible for custody of rehabilitation of numerous juveniles charged with murder and homicide out in that facility. We also have our own facilities. Custer comes to mind for someone who commits some type of a violent offense. And this is different than someone deciding they're going to go stab somebody. He was acquitted of the murder. He was convicted of the manslaughter. Choices have consequences. I want to deal with that. Choices do have consequences. But when the court makes a choice that has a consequence that affects substantial rights, there has to be substantial evidence to back that up. And our position here is that the juvenile court, Judge Tice, did not have the substantial evidence before him to come to the contradictory conclusions that he came to. And that's our position as it relates to that. Stab wounds. A.J. Wisely testified that Chance Darrow was being stabbed like this. His head up here, his stomach here, being stabbed like this. Those stab wounds had a downward trajectory. Jesse Krebs said that he was sitting on the ground on his bottom, stabbing upwards at the person who was pummeling him over the head, even after he said, I give, I'm done. If you bend over like this and you put your finger in your belly and you stand up, look at the direction of travel for the knife. The trajectory of the knife wound supports Jesse Krebs' self-defense claim, and it shows how incredible A.J. Wisely's claim about how this whole thing came down was as well. The video. The court said, as it related to the video, that there was nothing on that video that could not have been established through other methods, and in fact was established in other ways. I will tell you, when I watched the video, and I represent Defendant Krebs, when I watched the video, there's this beautiful young girl, she's crying, her man is up, and you can see his head in the window, you can see him slump over, and you can see him pull him out of the car on a stretcher. And I'll tell you what, it's pretty hard to get up and cross-examine someone and talk to a jury when they have just possibly witnessed the moment of death on film. And it's that type of emotion, those type of powerful feelings, those type of powerful visceral emotional responses that are not capable of being dealt with through cross-examination, which is why when we have these trials, there are some things that are just so prejudicial that you can't get into them because people will decide things in favor of that side just because they see him, and that's our position here.
Doesn't the state need that though to prove that there was a death?
Well, they proved there was a death with the coroner. They proved there was a death with the first responding officer, the reports of the death. They do not need a videotape of the person on the board to establish the death. In fact, we didn't dispute there was a death.
Well, of course, we've said in many cases that the defense doesn't control how the state puts its case in.
Understood. I agree with that. But my point is...
Was there any discussion of clipping just the last... it did have a scene of the... I mean, it did show where the accident or where the death occurred, or the fight occurred.
It's a good thing you bring that up. It did not show where the fight occurred. Okay. It came down the road and it entered in the front of the parking area. It did not show where the fight occurred. As I described in my brief, this field being kind of a long L, the patrol car would have stopped at the beginning of the L when the fight would have occurred over on the corner. As for the darkness, it's 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning. We can use our common experiences to establish the darkness. the state was prepared to prove everything they needed to prove before they discovered the tape. So I agree. I agree that when you see this this person on the board, someone could say, well, that could show the death, but it can be established in other ways without tapping into someone's feeling, deep feeling of sorrow and wanting to protect the girl and wanting to make it right for the death of this young man that is unrelated to the self-defense or the facts of the case.
Well, that kind of evidence, I mean, we've often said that just because the evidence hurts one side or other, that's not the test.
It's not.
The test is whether it persuades unfairly.
Whether it persuades by illegitimate means, and it would be our position here that tapping into those emotions is persuading by illegitimate means. The desire of a man to comfort a woman who's watching her boyfriend die is something that persuades by illegitimate means versus a person who's just looking at the evidence fairly, weighing it, and deciding then what is proven. So no, you can't get away with it by saying, oh, it hurts me, I don't want it in there, and that's not my position. My position is that it persuades by illegitimate means, it taps into the emotion of the situation, and it puts two strikes against Jesse Krebs right after it's played that can't be overcome by reason and evidence.
Your client was sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary?
He was.
And when would he be eligible for parole?
10 years.
So when he's 26?
Yes. Correct.
Of course, you'll have that conviction on his record for the rest of his life.
Yes.
If we sustain this.
Correct. I think I'm finished. Any other?
Okay. No one has ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you, Mr. Inch. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.